Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic. All of them were published in February of 2025. I hope you enjoy the program. We'll begin with politics. Trump signals he might ignore the courts. Yesterday, the president said that no judge should be allowed to rule against the changes his administration is making. By Jonathan Chait. The United States is sleepwalking into a constitutional crisis. Not only has the Trump administration seized for itself extra constitutional powers, but yesterday it raised the specter that, should the courts apply the text of the Constitution and negate its plans, it will simply ignore them. The Spanish political scientist Juan Linz once theorized that presidential systems are more likely than parliamentary systems to undergo constitutional crises or coup attempts, because they create dueling centers of power. The president and Congress both enjoy popular elections, creating a clash of popular mandates when opposing parties win simultaneous control. Who has the stronger claim to speak on behalf of the people? Linz asks, the president or the legislative majority that opposes his policies? Presidential systems would teeter and fall, he argued, when the president and Congress could not resolve their competing claims to legitimacy. A dozen years ago, when Republicans in Congress presented their majorities as having negated Barack Obama's electoral mandate and began threatening to precipitate a debt crisis to force him to accept their domestic economic plan, Linz's ideas began attracting renewed attention among liberal intellectuals. And indeed, the system is teetering. But the source of the emergency is nearly the opposite of what Linz predicted. The Trump administration is not refusing to share power with an opposing party. It is refusing to follow the constitutional limits of a government that its own party controls completely. Donald Trump is unilaterally declaring the right to ignore spending levels set by Congress and to eliminate agencies that Congress voted to create. What makes this demand so astonishing is that Trump could persuade Congress, which he commands in personality cult style, to follow his demands. Republicans presently control both houses of Congress, and any agency that Congress established, it can also cut or eliminate. Yet Trump refuses to even try to pass his plan democratically. And as courts have stepped in to halt his efforts to ignore the law, he is now threatening to ignore them, too. If a judge tried to tell a general how to conduct a military operation, that would be illegal, Vice President J.D. Vance posted on X yesterday morning. If a judge tried to command the attorney general in how to use her discretion as a prosecutor, that's also illegal. Judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power. Now, Vance was not quite making an unconditional vow to ignore a court order. Rather, he was stepping right up to the line. Obviously, judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power, but determining whether orders are legitimate is the very question the courts must decide. Elon Musk has described one judge who issued an unfavorable ruling as corrupt, using the word in the Trumpian sense, not to describe flouting ethics rules or profiting from office, but rather to mean opposed to Trump. and demanded his impeachment. Trump told reporters, "No judge should frankly be allowed to make that kind of a decision. It's a disgrace." Vance proposed in 2021 that Republicans, when they regain power, should replace the entire federal bureaucracy with political loyalists, and be prepared to refuse court rulings against such a clearly illegal act. And when the courts, because you will be taken to court, and when the courts stop you, he urged, stand before the country like Andrew Jackson did and say, "The Chief Justice has made his ruling. Now let him enforce it." So Vance has already reached the mental threshold of defying a court order. The question is whether he will see any of the current battles as presenting the right opportunity to take this step, and whether he will prevail on Trump, and realistically Musk, to do so. Just as Trump and Musk are refusing to submit their plans to a Congress that their party controls, they are at least toying with the notion of ignoring orders by a court they have shaped. The Supreme Court, which has final word on all constitutional disputes, has a 2-to-1 majority of Republican appointees. When Vance floated the idea of defying the courts in 2021, he was anticipating his party taking actions so indisputably illegal that not even friendly justices would swallow them. They are prepared to smash a system they control, simply because it won't move at the frantic pace they demand. Will Trump actually go as far as he, Vance, and Musk have suggested? The notion that they would so early in their term escalate to the highest level of constitutional crisis, short of canceling elections, seems difficult to believe. Quite possibly cooler heads will prevail. The trouble is that the Republican Party's cooler heads have been on a losing streak since November. Trump has appointed some of his most radical, unhinged, and unqualified followers to the cabinet. And with the sole exception of Matt Gaetz, whose attorney general nomination failed because he'd alienated so many fellow Republicans in Congress, they were sailing through. Trump freed all the January 6th insurrectionists and has begun firing and investigating the people in law enforcement who investigated the insurrection. Trump appointed a former January 6th lawyer, Ed Martin, as U.S. Attorney for the District for Columbia. Martin has presented himself in public as a kind of concierge lawyer for Trump and Musk, promising them special protection. "If people are discovered to have broken the law," he wrote to Musk, "or even acted simply unethically, we will investigate them, and we will chase them to the end of the earth to hold them accountable." The chief law enforcement officer in the nation's capital is stating in writing that he will investigate people for actions that he does not believe violated the law, but merely violated his own ethical sensibility. A rather frightening prospect. Just this weekend, the Washington Post reported that the administration is asking candidates for national security and law enforcement positions to answer questions such as, who were the real patriots on January 6th? Who won the 2020 election? And declining to offer jobs to those who fail to supply MAGA answers. Trump has sanctified the insurrection, has criminalized the prosecution of even its most violent activities, and is screening out anybody willing to question his belief that he is entitled to absolute power. If you had predicted things like this before the election, most Republicans would have accused you of Trump derangement syndrome. Yet Republicans have barely uttered a peep of protest in the face of these actions. Given his party's near-total acquiescence in every previous step toward authoritarianism, perhaps Trump would not have to be crazy to take the next one. The entire administration is intoxicated with power. The crisis lies not in the structure of government so much as in the character of the party that runs it, which refuses to accept the idea that its defeat is ever legitimate or that its power has any limits. That completes the article. The author, Jonathan Chait, is a staff writer at The Atlantic. The name of his article was Trump Signals He Might Ignore the Courts. The next article is titled A Very Christian Concept. The faith's mandate is more arduous than J.D. Vance's account seems to allow, by Elizabeth Brunig. Donald Trump campaigned in part on returning political power to American Christians. If I get in, you're going to be using that power at a level that you've never used before. Trump promised a room full of religious news broadcasters in February 2024. With your help and God's grace, the great revival of America begins on November 5th. At different campaign events, he vowed both that Christian leaders would have a line directly into the Oval Office and me, and that he would create a federal task force to stop the weaponization of our government against Christians. Now, not even 3 weeks into his new term, he has begun down quite the opposite path. Among the Trump administration's first efforts were orders that delivered a stunning blow to humanitarian organizations, including the suspension of foreign aid pending review, the halting of refugee resettlement programs, the dismantling of U.S. aid, and the freezing of all federal grants that normally flow to nonprofit organizations such as Catholic Charities USA, the official domestic relief agency of the Catholic Church. Catholic Charities represents a network of 168 local groups nationwide offering disaster assistance, meals, and housing for people in need, and refugee services and programs for migrants. According to White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt, the freeze was part of a broader effort to root out wokeness, though it's difficult to match that descriptor to this particular organization. And although the freeze on federal grants and loans was paused 2 days after Trump signed the order, many organizations are still unable to access funds. Late last month, hundreds of leaders from Catholic relief and aid organizations met with the annual Catholic Social Ministry Gathering in Washington, D.C. What ensued was a scene of real panic. Stefan Schneck, the chair of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, told me, "They were in shock, and they were disturbed, and they were feeling really panicky about the situation and wondering what to do." Schneck recalled speaking with an attendee from El Paso, Texas, who was suddenly unable to buy diapers for babies in his charity's care. "And this happened with no warning, no extensions," Schneck said. "It just happened overnight." Catholic agencies providing relief overseas were also affected by the freeze on foreign aid, which came with a stop-work order that suspended operations. Along with the shutdown of federal funding for so many Catholic charitable organizations, Trump also revoked a Joe Biden-era policy that prevented Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents from apprehending people in near-sensitive locations, such as churches and schools. The change elicited a statement from the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, which registered its dismay at the transformation of places for care, healing, and solace into places of fear and uncertainty for those in need, and called for a better path forward that protects the dignity of all those we serve, upholds the sacred duty of our providers, and ensures our borders and immigration system are governed with mercy and justice. The statement set off a back and forth between the bishops and Vice President J.D. Vance, who responded to the bishops on Face the Nation late last month, saying that the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops needs to actually look in the mirror a little bit and recognize that when they receive over $100 million to help resettle illegal immigrants, are they worried about humanitarian concerns, or are they actually worried about their bottom line? The USCCB followed up with another statement, saying that, faithful to the teachings of Jesus Christ, the Catholic Church has a long history of serving refugees. In our arrangements with the government, the USCCB receives funds to do this work. However, these funds are not sufficient to cover the entire cost of these programs. Nonetheless, this remains a work of mercy and ministry of the Church. Vance, speaking with the Fox News host Sean Hannity, provided further Catholic reasoning for his administration's approach to migrants and refugees, arguing that he thinks it's a very Christian concept that you love your family, and that you love your neighbor, and then you love your community, and then you love your fellow citizens in their own country. And then, after that, you can focus and prioritize the rest of the world. A statement to which the bishops have not responded. If they did, however, I would imagine they would point out that Jesus addresses this matter in his Sermon on the Mount, saying, "If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect." The Christian mandate is more arduous than Vance's account seems to allow. Catholic politicians disputing the bishop's witness to the faith is nothing new, though the allegations of avarice and corruption are somewhat surprising and presage bitter conflict ahead. Perhaps that could be helpful insofar as it would sharply distinguish the teaching of the Church from certain politicized versions of Catholicism, tailored to the ideological preferences of their confessors. The Church is called to be a sign of contradiction, a bulwark of Christian priorities against the demands of the political and cultural eras that the faithful pass through. Comporting with political and cultural demands is what politicians do. The degree to which Catholic politicians do the same is the degree to which they ought to suspect themselves spiritually compromised. Perhaps they all are, and perhaps so are we. In fact, the tendency of humankind to be self-serving and deceitful is part of what makes me believe that Christianity is at its purest and most beautiful when it is counterintuitive and unwieldy, that is, when it is least amenable to human convenience. The command to love even those who aren't your kith and kin is an excellent example of just that. The command to serve the weakest and most outcast members of society is another. Thus, the decision to love and serve the stranger, the refugee, and the foreigner with charity is a hallmark of the Christian faith, such that a government crackdown on this work seems to be a threat to Christian practice itself, or an attempt to reshape it into something else altogether. That completes the article. The title was "A Very Christian Concept" by Atlantic staff writer Elizabeth Brunig. The next title is "What an America First Diet Would Really Look Like." The notion that the U.S. could produce all of its food domestically is nice, but very far from reality. By Yasmin Tayag. For a moment, the threat of Guayacopolis loomed over America. Had President Donald Trump's proposed tariffs on Mexico and Canada gone into effect, the prices of avocados and tomatoes would have skyrocketed in the approach to Super Bowl Sunday. Trump may be bluffing about his willingness to start a trade war, but the grace period he negotiated with those nations lasts just 30 days. Yesterday, he said that he would announce tariffs on even more countries, he didn't specify which, in the coming week. Soon, Americans could again be clutching our guacamole. If the tariffs Trump has threatened to go into effect do go into effect, they would quickly raise the prices, not just of avocados, but of strawberries, cucumbers, bell peppers, oranges, countless processed foods, and other grocery staples that are already becoming less affordable for many people. Any pain that tariffs cause American consumers would, in Trump's view, which he boomed on Truth Social, be only a temporary bump on the road to the golden age of America. Implicit in that idea, and the reality of an actual trade war, is the assumption that the U.S. can make up for any lost imports on its own. Trump's stance on agriculture is the same as his stance on everything else, America first. The notion that the country could produce all of its food domestically is nice, even admirable. An American first food system would promote eating seasonally and locally, supporting more small farmers in the process. But that is not how most people eat now. Eating America first would restrict the variety that shoppers have come to expect. Eating fresh blueberries year-round would be impossible. Barring the overhaul of all U.S. agriculture, it would mean a less healthy diet, too. The Guayacopolis near miss was a reminder of the precarious state of our food system. Much of the food we want is not produced at home. Trump's tariff might amount to nothing but political posturing. During his first term, he threatened Mexico with a 5% tariff, then backed off 2 weeks later. The current grace period could extend indefinitely, but an actual trade war would have a dramatic impact on the food supply. Avocados are a perfect case study. The national obsession is staggering. In 2023, the average person ate more than 9 pounds of them, roughly equivalent to 27 average-sized fruit. More than 90% of the avocados Americans buy come from Mexico. They are the nation's top import in terms of value. Luis Ribera, an agricultural economics professor at Texas A&M University, told me. Because they are much more expensive than, say, bananas, the effect of a 25% tariff, plus its associated costs, would be more significant. A small Haas avocado worth 50 cents might go to $1.50, Ribera said. Avocado-dependent businesses would feel it too. A Chipotle representative told me that tariffs would certainly raise prices. The America First perspective frames tariffs as an opportunity to boost domestic production. Roughly 10% of avocados available in America are grown here. The majority come from California and Florida, and Hawaii make up the remainder. Zach Conrad, a food systems expert at the College of William and Mary, ticked off a multitude of reasons domestic production could not recreate our current avocado bounty. Avocados grow in too few areas of the U.S., and on top of that, they largely produce fruit only from spring to early fall. Trump's immigration policies threaten the already dwindling farm labor workforce. Avocados aside, the U.S. does already produce enough food to feed itself, and then some. about 4,000 calories worth of food a day were available for each person in 2010, according to the USDA's most recent estimate. That year, the average person consumed 2,500 calories a day. But food is more than just calories. The U.S. produces plenty of grains, oils, sweeteners, and meat, but far less fresh produce and legumes. In recent years, the country has become a net importer of food. The food group that we produce the least of to meet our dietary needs is fruit and vegetables, Conrad said. In 2022, 69% of the fresh vegetables and 51% of the fresh fruits imported by the U.S. came from Mexico. Meat, canola oil, and biscuits and wafers account for most of the U.S. imports from Canada, but 20% of this country's fresh vegetable imports come from there, too. Theoretically, America could grow all of its own produce, but that would require a complete remaking of the food system. More land would have to be dedicated to growing fruits, vegetables, and nuts, and less of it to grains and sweeteners. It would also mean addressing labor shortages, increasing the number of farmers, finding suitable land, and building new infrastructure to process and ship each new crop. Every one of these issues is incredibly complex. Many fruits and vegetables are so delicate that they must be harvested by hand, so machines can't supplement human labor. A wheat farmer can't just switch to growing tomatoes. Specialty crops, a category that includes any fruit, vegetable, or tree nut, require specialty knowledge, as well as specialty equipment, which can cost millions. Solving all of these problems, which would likely be impossible, would take many years, Conrad said. Cutting off Canada would have subtler but no less extensive effects than abstaining from Mexican produce. Grains, beef, and pork are produced domestically, but sourcing them abroad can be less expensive, Chris Barrett, a professor who specializes in agricultural economics at Cornell University, told me. Demand for beef on the west coast of the U.S., for instance, can be cheaper to fulfill from the Canadian prairies than from an East Coast packing house. Canada's other big contribution to the American diet is canola oil, which is produced stateside in relatively small amounts. The ongoing campaign against seed oils, led by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., may claim that Americans would be better off without canola oil. But for now, America runs on processed food. Without cheap canola oil from Canada, many frozen foods and packaged goods will cost more. That excellent ratatouille you get in a can, even if you think it's healthy, probably contains a bit of imported oil. It's going to get priced up, Barrett said. The problems with an America First food system wouldn't just be about cost. It would lack diversity. There would be no typical tropical fruits such as mangoes and coconuts, and far fewer specialty varieties such as sumo citrus and Meyer lemons, because domestic growers would have to focus on the basics. Given the current emphasis on meat, grains, and sweeteners, it would encourage a less healthy diet, too. Striving toward the Make America Healthy Again ideal, pushed by RFK Jr., would be made more difficult with fewer choices and higher prices. As my colleague Nicholas Florco wrote recently, people buy food on the basis of taste, convenience, and cost. America could supply its entire population with a healthy diet, as Conrad's research has shown, but not without totally blowing up its agricultural priorities. The notion of an American first food supply, harvesting homegrown produce, eating seasonally, supporting farmers, does align with the idea of returning to a pastoral era, which has been embraced by RFK Jr.'s supporters, raw milk drinkers, and farmers market devotees across the political spectrum. It's a nice way of thinking about food, Conrad said, but it just doesn't align with the reality of how Americans currently eat. Every time we go to the grocery store, we choose from a marvelous variety of foods from around the world. A McDonald's hamburger with fries, that most American meals is made with sesame seeds from Mexico and canola oil from Canada. That eating vatfuls of guacamole every year in the middle of February is a pillar of American culture, is a testament to our interdependence with our neighbors. That completes the article. The title was What an America First Diet Would Really Look Like, by Atlantic staff writer Yasmin Tayag. I'll take just a moment to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading from the online edition of the Atlantic. All of the articles were published in February of 2025. The title of the next article is How to Rebuild from the Ashes. Santa Rosa's Coffee Park was destroyed by a fire in 2017, but mostly recovered. It could be a model for Altadena and Pacific Palisades, by Connor Fredersdorf. On the night of October 8, 2017, a small fire ignited near the northern tip of Napa Valley. Hot, dry winds gusting up to 80 miles an hour drove the blaze southwest toward the city of Santa Rosa, where it hopped over Highway 101, six lanes wide at that point, into neighborhoods, including one called Coffee Park. Nearly everything in that subdivision, including 1,422 houses, burned completely. Yet today, a casual visitor would not think the neighborhood was the site of a recent catastrophe, instead finding custom homes with tidy yards, clean sidewalks, and trees that have matured into juveniles. That's because Coffee Park residents rebuilt and reoccupied 80% of the houses there within 3 years. The recovery wasn't total. Five Coffee Park residents died in the fire. Some people decided to relocate. A few lots remain empty, but the community has endured and in many ways is thriving, or so several residents told me after I knocked on their doors last month, looking for lessons that could be useful for people displaced by the recent Los Angeles area fires in Pacific Palisades and Altadena. What do you know now, I ask dozens of residents, that you wish you had known when you lost your house? I also ask local officials for their reflections on how to rebuild. Santa Rosa, with roughly 175,800 residents, is far smaller than Los Angeles, population 3.8 million, let alone L.A. County, population 9.7 million. With many attendant differences in how the local government runs, and the number of structures destroyed in the Palisades and Altadena fires combined is nearly three times what Santa Rosa lost in 2017. But like Pacific Palisades and Altadena, Santa Rosa lost whole neighborhoods that no one expected to be consumed by wildfire, including Coffee Park. Santa Rosa officials emphasized to me that, in their experience, recovery requires local government to be flexible. But perhaps the most important transferable lesson that I gathered on my visit there, one touted by both residents and officials, is that neighbors can hasten their area's recovery if they organize. Banding together helped Coffee Park residents in conflicts and negotiations with federal, state, and local officials. And it didn't just yield more political power. It helped neighbors benefit from one another's strengths, compensate for their own weaknesses, and create a stronger sense of community than before. At 9:45 p.m. on the night the fire started, Von Radke was upstairs in the two-story house in Coffee Park, where he and his wife had lived for more than 25 years. He'd undergone hip replacement surgery 2 weeks prior and was turning in early. He recalls the wind blowing mightily as he drifted off to sleep. Hours later, he woke up and smelled smoke, but groggy from painkillers, he at first dismissed it. Eventually, he woke his wife, Jan, and hobbled downstairs. When he looked out a window, he saw embers in the air and 40-foot-tall Italian cypress trees bending 45 degrees in the wind. It was past time to flee, but just backing out of the driveway took 5 minutes. The whole neighborhood was trying to evacuate. Traffic stopped for 20 minutes or more. Von saw people trying to fight fires with garden hoses and more houses aflame. He and Jan might need to flee on foot, he thought, knowing how hopeless that would be in his condition. For the first time in my life, I thought I was going to die, he recalled. Finally, traffic started to move. Like many others who saw the fire up close, Radke's went on to suffer a significant amount of PTSD, he told me. When we spoke in the front yard of his rebuilt home, a small two-story house surrounded by a well-tended garden, he focused on the psychological needs of the survivors. In the months after the fire, while they were still scattered in various hotel rooms and rentals, some of his neighbors began convening to talk through their escape experiences, their struggles, and how to rebuild. The best-known gathering came to be called Wine Wednesdays. It still occasionally takes place. To work through his own experience, Radke said he found a therapist who donated his services to fire survivors. It's psychologically challenging to let people help you, to go to the local school and pick through donations of hand-me-down clothing to get you through those first weeks. But it's important to learn a bit of humility, Radke said, because people want to help, and you need help. Once the fire was out, Coffee Park residents were eager to return to their properties and confused and frustrated by not knowing when they would be allowed in. Jeff Oprecki, who'd lived in the neighborhood for 5 years, craved reliable information and had more ways of getting it than most. As a commercial insurance agent, he had colleagues who dealt with homeowners insurance and contacts with developers and contractors. What we need, he thought, is a forum where residents can gather to ask questions and get accurate answers from knowledgeable sources. He called a friend at a nearby junior college who agreed to donate use of its auditorium and spread the word about a community meeting. Officials from the city, builders, and insurance experts were all on hand. I thought I had done my good deed, he told me. Then people started asking me, when is the next meeting? With Sonoma County Supervisor James Gore, Oprecki organized a bigger town hall, drawing hundreds of attendees to an arts center. At that gathering, Coffee Park residents divided themselves into 5 groups based on their addresses, and each group nominated a captain to represent them. Weekly meetings followed, and soon Oprecki founded Coffee Strong, a nonprofit to help residents get back into their homes as quickly and easily as possible. Organizing in that way helped us continue to share information, but more importantly, it legitimized us in the eyes of government agencies, he said.
if they were contacted by Coffee Strong, it wasn't one person calling. It was one person who represented thousands. The group began to solve problems no one had anticipated. When the neighborhood had been built, the developer had constructed walls around its edges that residents assumed belonged to the city, but were in fact the responsibility of homeowners. Had residents known that earlier, they would have had the damaged walls hauled away during the free debris removal offered to them as part of disaster relief efforts. Now they faced having to pay thousands of dollars for the walls' removal, and still more to replace them piecemeal. Coffee Strong raised $500,000 for the project and persuaded contractors to donate labor. After many of the initial hurdles to rebuilding had been cleared, the U.S. Postal Service told residents that instead of having mailboxes at their houses as before, they'd now have centralized mailboxes, a proposal that many of them strongly rejected. When your neighborhood burns down, it's a total loss of control, and for a lot of people, rebuilding your home, which involves making a lot of choices, restores a sense of control, Oak Repke said. So when someone from the federal government comes and tells you, we're doing this in a way that's worse than what you had, and you have no control, it upsets people a lot. Under pressure from Coffee Strong, as well as allies in the city, the Postal Service reversed course. While Coffee Park residents were organizing, city staffers in Santa Rosa had to figure out how to support people affected by the fire citywide. Initially, the new demands were almost overwhelming. First responders were exhausted. Municipal structures and infrastructure had been destroyed in the fire. City officials had to coordinate with Sonoma County, the state of California, FEMA, and more. Thousands of residents were displaced. All wanted information, and meanwhile, normal city business wore on. Gabe Osborne was a municipal employee working in a role unrelated to fire recovery, who lived in a house just beyond where the fire had reached. Feeling survivor's remorse, he expressed interest to his boss in helping with the recovery. Osborne started attending community meetings for fire victims as a representative of the city, and soon was assigned to advance fire recovery full-time on behalf of the planning department. He would be among the primary city employees working with residents to rebuild and ultimately attended more than 300 meetings with fire victims, he told me. The goal, Osborne said, was not just to restore the 5% of the city's housing stock that had been lost. It was important for us to keep the fire victims here, he said. They were the fabric of our community. Early on, Osborne feared that the area's small construction industry would be unable to supply enough contractors, laborers, and materials to rebuild affordably. As it turned out, free markets and assistance from flexible regulators was a powerful combination. Builders responded to the new demand for construction, and the city offered steep discounts on building permits, created a permitting center dedicated to fire recovery, and worked with surveyors to go through the areas most affected by the fire, instead of requiring each resident to pay their own surveyors to clarify property lines. If residents wanted to change the footprint of their house, city planners worked with them. There were limits to what the city would allow, but multiple residents told me that the staff tried to get to yes, rather than insisting on stricter adherence to the rules as they'd existed before the fire. Will Los Angeles be as good a municipal partner to its fire-affected residents as Santa Rosa was? L.A. officials have already started waiving some building requirements, and the city certainly has more resources than Santa Rosa. But I've heard horror stories from both homeowners and businesses about the city's endlessly complex rules. so I fear that because its bureaucracy is so big and difficult to navigate, it could fail the fire victims. Pacific Palisades is part of the city of Los Angeles, while Altadena is an unincorporated community in L.A. County, and will be subject to county building rules and agencies. Can residents of Altadena and Pacific Palisades improve their recovery by organizing themselves? There I am more hopeful. Like any neighborhood, even a suburban one, where the homes are mostly of similar size and value, Coffee Park is filled with people of all sorts. Knocking on its doors, I encountered friendly invitations to come inside and gruff suspicions that I was soliciting. I met professionals with contacts in industries as varied as home construction and therapy. Canny people you'd want negotiating a lawsuit on your behalf, and warm-hearted sorts you'd want commiserating with you after the loss of a wedding ring or a pet. Santa Rosans have gotten used to sharing their knowledge with other communities that suffer from fires. Some of the advice they relayed to me was practical and time-sensitive. Remember to cancel your cable bill or home alarm system or landline so you don't continue to be charged. Walk your lot with a metal detector before the rubble is hauled off. Jeff Okrepke now sits on the city council, and Gabe Osborne is the head of planning. Both have shared what they've learned with officials and residents of Los Angeles, Maui, and beyond. As for Coffee Strong, the nonprofit is now inactive, having succeeded in its core mission, getting residents home. The group's website remains online as a resource. Among its attestations, nobody can or should shoulder all of this alone. That's the end of the article by Connor Frederisdorf, and the title of it was How to Rebuild from the Ashes. Our last article is The New Authoritarianism by Stephen Levitsky. With the leader of a failed coup back in the White House and pursuing an unprecedented assault on the constitutional order, many Americans are starting to wrap their mind around what authoritarianism could look like in America. If they have a hard time imagining something like the single party or military regimes of the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany, or more modern regimes like those in China or Russia, that is with good reason. A full-scale dictatorship, in which elections are meaningless and regime opponents are locked up, exiled, or killed, remains highly unlikely in America. But that doesn't mean the country won't experience authoritarianism in some form. Rather than fascism or single-party dictatorship, the United States is sliding toward a more 21st-century model of autocracy, competitive authoritarianism, a system in which parties compete in elections, but incumbent abuse of power systematically tilts the playing field against the opposition. In his first weeks back in office, Donald Trump has already moved strongly in this direction. He is attempting to purge the civil service and directing politicized investigation against rivals. He has pardoned violent paramilitary supporters and is seeking to unilaterally seize control over spending from Congress. This is a coordinated effort to dig in, cement power, and weaken rivals. Unlike in a full-scale dictatorship, in competitive authoritarian regimes, opposition forces are legal and above ground, and they often seriously vie for power. Elections may be fiercely contested, but incumbents deploy the machinery of government to punish, harass, co-opt, or sideline their opponents, disadvantaging them in every contest, and in so doing entrenching themselves in power. This is what happened in Venezuela under Hugo Chavez, and in contemporary El Salvador, Hungary, India, Tunisia, and Turkey. Crucially, this abuse of the state's power does not require upending the Constitution. Competitive autocracies usually begin by capturing the referees, replacing professional civil servants and policy specialists with loyalists in key public agencies, particularly those that investigate or prosecute wrongdoing, adjudicate disputes, or regulate economic life. Elected autocrats such as Chavez, Vladimir Putin, Viktor Orban, Narendra Modi, and Nayib Bukele all purged public prosecutors' offices, intelligence agencies, tax authorities, electoral authorities, media regulatory bodies, courts, and other state institutions, and packed them with loyalists. Trump is not hiding his efforts to do the same. He has thus far fired, or declared his intention to fire, leading to their resignation, the FBI director, the IRS commissioner, EEOC commissioners, the National Labor Relations Board chair, and other nominally independent officials, reissued a renamed Schedule F, which strips firing protections from huge swaths of the civil service, expanded hiring authorities that make it easier to fill public positions with allies, purged more than a dozen inspectors general in apparent violation of the law, and even ordered civil servants to inform on one another. Once state agencies are packed with loyalists, they may be deployed to investigate and prosecute rivals and critics, including politicians, media companies, editors, journalists, influential CEOs, and administrators of elite universities. In the United States, this may be done via the Justice Department and the FBI, the IRS, congressional investigations, and other public agencies responsible for regulatory oversight and compliance. It may also be done via defamation or other private lawsuits. The administration doesn't have to jail its opponents to bully, harm, and ultimately intimidate them into submission. Indeed, because U.S. courts remain independent, few targets of selective prosecution are likely to be convicted and imprisoned. But mere investigations are a form of harassment. Targets of selective investigation or prosecution will be forced to devote considerable time, energy, and resources to defending themselves. They will spend their savings on lawyers, their lives will be disrupted, their professional careers will be sidetracked, and their reputations damaged. At minimum, they and their families will suffer months and perhaps years of anxiety and sleepless nights. Plus, the administration need not target all critics. A few high-profile attacks, such as a case against Liz Cheney, a prominent media outlet, or selective regulatory retaliations against a major company, may serve as an effective deterrent against future opposition. Competitive authoritarian governments further subvert democracy by shielding those who engage in criminal or anti-democratic behavior through captured referees and other impunity mechanisms. Trump's decision to pardon violent January 6th insurrectionists and purge prosecutors who were involved in those cases, for example, sends a strong signal that violent or anti-democratic actors will be protected under the new administration. Indeed, that's how many pardon recipients are interpreting the pardons. Likewise, a loyalist Justice Department and FBI could disregard acts of political violence, such as attacks on or threats against campaign workers, election officials, journalists, politicians, activists, protesters, and voters. They could also decline to investigate or prosecute officials who work to manipulate or even steal elections. This may appear far-fetched, but it is precisely what enabled the consolidation of authoritarian rule in the Jim Crow South. Protected by local and often federal authorities in the aftermath of Reconstruction, white supremacist groups used violent terror and election fraud to consolidate power and disenfranchise African Americans across the region. Finally, state institutions may be used to co-opt business, media, and other influential societal actors. When regulatory bodies and other public agencies are politicized, government officials can use decisions regarding things such as mergers and acquisitions, licenses, waivers, government contracts, and tax-exempt status to reward or punish parties depending on their political alignment. Business leaders, media companies, universities, foundations, and other organizations have a lot at stake when government officials make decisions on tariff waivers, regulatory enforcement, tax-exempt status, and government contracts and concessions. If they believe that those decisions are made on political rather than technical grounds, many of them will modify their behavior accordingly. Thus, if business leaders come to the conclusion that funding opposition candidates or independent media is financially risky, or that remaining silent rather than criticizing the administration is more profitable, they will change their behavior. Several of the country's wealthiest individuals and companies, including Jeff Bezos, Tim Cook, Sam Altman, Mark Zuckerberg, and Disney, already appear to be adjusting in that way. And with that, we have run out of time. The name of this article was The New Authoritarianism by Steve Levitsky. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader today. I hope you enjoyed the program. The articles I've read were published in February of 2025 in the online edition of The Atlantic. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you've missed an article you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website. On that, the next page, click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then click on Demand Podcasts. You'll see on that page the list of articles available to you. Hopefully the one you're looking for is there. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.